So this morning I'm giving my third talk in a series I've been doing on the Buddhist path and psychotherapy. And just to summarize very quickly, the first talk was about cognitive therapy and the cognitive components of the path, which are the first two components, right understanding and right thought. And those are also the last two components. There are 9 and 10, but that's for another time. And the second talk I gave was on the behavioral components of the path and behavioral therapy, speech, action, and livelihood. So today, in 40 or 45 minutes, I'm going to try to talk about psychodynamic therapy and the last portion of the path, which is meditation, effort, bare awareness, and concentration, meditation. So psychodynamic, and you know, I'm generalizing, so I'm way generalizing. Because anyway, having said that, psychodynamic therapists and meditators in the Buddhist tradition would agree that the ego is a bit of consciousness which floats in an ocean of darkness. So in psychodynamic therapy, behavior and relationships are shaped by conscious and unconscious influences and include factors such as internal processes, motivations and drives, childhood experiences, etc., etc., with the basic underlying assumption that there's some dissonance between what we're conscious of and what we're not conscious of. There's some dissonance and often conflict. So if I were to go in to see a psychodynamic therapist or one who was trained in that mode, and of course, most modern therapists are trained in all three of these, but some aren't. Some just like one more than the other. They would help me resolve my conflicted feelings, and they'd put a major emphasis on my past experience that's still present in my unconscious. And I would talk, and the therapist would make some interpretations about my words and behaviors. Pretty simple. So psychodynamic therapy says that there's a storehouse of socially unacceptable desires, traumatic memories, and painful emotions in the ocean or surrounding the iceberg, a storehouse, and that the unconscious mind determines our reactivity, and the conscious mind our actions. And often our reactions and our actions are totally interspersed and we don't know. So a few more things about the unconscious mind. The unconscious mind preserves the body. It'll fight anything that appears to be a threat. Ever notice that? It'll fight anything that appears to be a threat. So if you want to change, you have to show your unconscious mind, according to psychodynamic therapists, about how you have to show your unconscious about how that behavior is hurting. How's it hurting you? The unconscious mind also runs the body. It handles all of our basic physical functions, our breathing. Luckily, we don't have to think about our breathing, our heart rate, our immune system. It handles all that stuff. The unconscious mind is like my grandson who just turned 7. And had his birthday party at McDonald's in Paris. Just like my grandson who just turned 7, it needs very clear directions and takes instructions very literally. Very literally. So if I, as I was getting ready to give this talk, I was thinking about it. I was thinking, well, geez, I said I was going to talk about this and this whole, you know, vast arena of commonality and difference in 45 minutes, No, I could have gotten anxious about it. Still, instead of getting anxious, I just sort of wondered at my audacity. But, you know, life is short, right? But if I'd gotten anxious, I might have saying to myself, oh, giving a Sunday talk is a pain in the neck. What would have happened? My unconscious probably would have interpreted that. Oh, it's a pain in the neck, and I would have gotten a pain. This happens all the time, you guys. You'd be amazed at how powerful your unconscious is. It happens all. But I didn't say that to me, so I didn't get to myself, so I didn't get a pain. Well, I probably said something else. You know, who knows? Because we're not that aware. This is this ocean of darkness that we're generally not even aware of. And our cyclic dynamic therapist helps us become aware of it. Also, another way the unconscious is like my 7-year-old grandson is that it's very moral. He really knows what's right. He really knows when his brother is doing something wrong. He's very vocal about it. Now, when he's doing something wrong, it's different. But he's very moral. Very moral, right? And we develop that morality early based on our experience with our parents, our surroundings. If you were taught early on that sex is nasty, then you're unconscious, regardless how liberated you are in the 21st century. Your unconscious will respond to that teaching even after your conscious mind has rejected it. You guys know that, right? It's not rocket science. Another thing that the unconscious does, it communicates through emotion and symbols to get your attention. If you suddenly feel afraid, your unconscious is saying your survival is at risk. So the first couple of times I gave a talk in this room many, many, many years ago was not my idea, it was my teacher's idea. I blame it on him. You can blame everything on your teachers and your parents going back. I was not ready to give a talk, but he decided I was. So the first time, I sat right here, probably. I don't remember where we sat. Probably right here. I must have sat here. And I really prepared for my talk. And I've been practicing Zen for quite a while when I gave my first talk. 10 years, at least. 12 years. So I had all my ducks in a row. But when I picked up the notes, and I only had a few notes, as I get older, I have more and more notes. And why that is, I don't know. It should be the other way around. But as I picked up my notes, my hands, I was like this. Oh, I better not pick up my notes. People will see my hands are shaking. And then my voice is shaking. But I thought I was relaxed ahead of time. I had it all my ducks in a row. But my unconscious was saying, this is threatening, Tim. Your survival's at stake here. That's what it was telling me. It was not in sync with my conscious, because my conscious mind was all ready. I was ready. So the unconscious stores and organizes memories. It hides certain memories, such as traumas, that have strong negative emotions, until we're ready, until we're mature enough to process them consciously. We know this. We know this. When it senses that we're ready, whether we consciously think we are or not, it brings them up. It brings them up. The unconscious mind doesn't process negatives. It absorbs pictures rather than words. So if I said to myself, I don't want to procrastinate in preparing for this psychodynamic talk, I would get a picture in my unconscious mind of myself procrastinating. So then I need to switch that picture from the negative to the positive. Let's get to work. Because remember, it's only 7 years old, and actually less than 7 years old in many ways. It makes associations and it learns quickly to protect us. It wants to protect us. It's fight or flight. Protect us. If you had bad experiences in school when you were young, then when you are in classroom-type situation, you come to a classroom situation here, you had bad experiences at school, you're anxious when you're sitting in the class. Maybe you even get a little sweaty palms, then you're really embarrassed. But that was your early learning. It helped you learn that really early to protect you. So then you say to yourself, I'm decided to do this class, but I see that you have this group discussion. This is not going to be fun. This is not going to be fun. And you just say that to yourself. So I was good in school. I had good experiences, except for one thing. I'm left-handed. And Mrs. Werner, in the first grade, said we had to write with our right hands. And it was awful. I couldn't write with my right hand at all. It was all scraggly and crooked and bent. And I went and told my parents, and I was crying. And my parents said, oh, she's old-fashioned. We'll have to get on her case. Well, apparently they got on her case, but she was never nice to me after that. And so I learned very, very early that I was threatened when I wrote. Writing was a threatening experience for me. Not academic stuff, but writing. So first time I had to do Roxas. I'm the guiding teacher, so I write on people's Roxas. This one is emptiness Roxas, but I write on people's Roxas. You know, I give them a name and I write. I was anxious. Second time I was anxious. Third time I was anxious. Oh, I don't seem to be anxious anymore. You know, whatever. So if you did well in sports when you were a kid, your unconscious will remember that. Sports equals success. It equals having a good time. And you'll feel positive and energized. So most psychodynamic therapy focuses on bringing unconscious stuff out. You're sitting quietly with a therapist. You're sitting quietly. And the therapist is asking queer questions about what's going on. You're letting them come out. And the therapist is guiding you. He's guiding you. So what I've talked about so far is not too much positive stuff in the unconscious, but a very important function that it serves in terms of self-preservation. But there have been a lot of therapists who've gotten into positive aspects of the unconscious, starting with Jung. This is where Jung broke with Freud, because he said, in addition to this individual conscious unconscious, there's a collective unconscious, which includes archetypes, the great mother, the wise old man, that are present within this collective unconscious. Collective, we all can access it. Can include wise animal, mythological beings. So Jung, working with that was really, really important. And for his disciples, Karen Suno, who was the guiding teacher here before me, she was really into Jung. She was a Jungian therapist, so she knew Jung much better than I do, much better. So when I was, 25 years ago, I'm getting so old that, you know, it's just hard for me to place things. But let's say 25 years ago, I worked with a Native American medicine man. And I did a vision quest with him. And he talked to me about the eagle could help me on my vision quest, because I was there by myself for a long time without eating, I got to sleep, but without eating. And I said, oh, that's cool. And then when he said that, and then afterwards he said to me, well, had I seen the eagle? And I said, yeah, I did. It was really helpful. So for Elmer, that eagle is a spirit presence. For you, that's something with a wisdom being that emanates from our collective unconscious. And a wisdom that we want to honor because it's here. We all have that wisdom. The third guy that I'm going to talk about briefly in regard to psychodynamic therapy, and you know there are so many different people, but is Milton Erickson and his disciples, NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Programming. Milton Erickson says, also says like you, and the unconscious can be a very positive force. It can help in the healing process. And through trance, and let's just say a deep meditative state so we don't get caught on this side of mystical trance, hypnosis. Erickson only used hypnosis indirectly, and all he did was tell stories, basically. So, but in a heightened state of awareness, the therapist could harness the healing within the client's unconscious, not to give insight, because insight didn't help from Erickson's point of view. But you could directly be with the unconscious, speak to the unconscious, and the unconscious could change. Now, let's say that I'm working with an Ericksonian therapist, and I bring up Mrs. Werner. You remember who Mrs. Werner was? That was 13 minutes ago. Mrs. Werner. And I say, I gotta keep writing on these things, but I hate it. And then so he says, okay, well, let's meditate together, and we breathe together. And then, you know, he does all this indirectly. This is not direct hypnosis, indirectly. So, and you may find yourself back in Mrs. Werner's classroom in your hometown, and I don't know what the wall looks like or even what Mrs. Werner looks like, but I think you know, so, right, he's evoking with me, in me, some powerful memories. And then I'm saying, yeah, and I say, well, and then I'd say to him something about, yeah, so Mrs. Werner looks really mean. She's scowling at me. And he said, yes, maybe Mrs. Werner had something to eat that she didn't like for dinner, for lunch. You think that's possible? Well, you know, he tries to go with me. And then he says, and is it possible that someone's coming in the room who works with Mrs. Werner, or who it's even Mrs. Werner's boss, and notices how wonderfully you're writing with your left hand? I wonder if it's possible to see something like that. Don't use my words. Just follow along and see if you can see who's really appreciating your left-handedness. And inevitably, I'll see someone really appreciating my left-handedness in that classroom, in the first grade. And that's called reframing my early experience. Then I'll come back to the room and we'll work with that for quite a while, you know, a few sessions if necessary, until the experience has been reframed. What this reminds me of is my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, in retreats. So in retreats, and Katagiri Roshi did this some too, but Suzuki more, in retreats, you know, we're all sitting facing the wall except the teacher. And so we're most of us are in some kind of meditative state, even if we're exhausted. Exhaustion actually is kind of a meditative state because you're less defended. You're more open. And then Suzuki would just kind of start talking to us sometimes. He just started kind of talking. And he would, there'd be imagery and things he'd say, and they really penetrated me. I really felt them deeply, much more than I felt during his Sunday talks. So when I began learning about Ericksonian therapy, I just remembered Suzuki, of course, didn't know anything about Ericksonian therapy. But he knew about how to be with people and how to help them evoke in a meditative state some deep feelings and calmness. So when we have difficulties, the premise in psychodynamic therapy is that the conscious and unconscious are out of sync. Being in sync mostly involves developing a new narrative and a sense of who we are based on the new narrative that makes us more functional. So my left-handedness is really wonderful. I'm lucky. I'm Obama and me are left-handed. Obama and me and who else? Who are the other presidents who are left-handed? You know, it's us guys together. Wow. You know, a new narrative, right? So that's 20 minutes on psychodynamic therapy. Now I'm going to talk about the Buddhist path. So the meditative component of the Buddhist path. Remember the three components to the path, to the meditative path, which are the 6, 7, and 8 steps in the Eightfold Path. Effort, bare awareness, and concentration. Now I'm using the term bare awareness rather than mindfulness. And I have been using the term bare awareness for many, many years rather than mindfulness. And I will talk a little bit about that now. It's a translation of a Sanskrit and Pali word, and it's not always translated as mindfulness. Sometimes it is translated as bare awareness. The reason there are three reasons I use that term rather than mindfulness. The first two are that mindfulness is not very descriptive. Bare awareness is quite descriptive. This is without criticism, without judgment. You're just being aware. You're just feeling your senses. You're just seeing the sights. You're just being with bare awareness. It's descriptive. It's descriptive. The second is that mindfulness leaves out the heart. It's just as much heartfulness as mindfulness. If you look at the Pali and the Sanskrit, which I don't know, I only know enough to know that. I don't know much at all. But it leaves out the heart mind. Awareness has to include the heart. If it's just the mind, then we're cut off at our neck. The third reason I don't use it is that it's become a cliche. Geez, our country is amazing, isn't it? 10 years ago, nobody heard of mindfulness. People thought it was bizarre and Buddhists. And now, Newsweek magazine, the New York Times. The New York Times had 6 articles on mindfulness in the last year. Look them up. 6 articles. So our culture changes so fast that I don't know how helpful these words are for us when we don't really get into the practice. So anyway, that's why I use bare awareness. So anyway, that's meditation, concentration, and bare awareness. And of course, the goal is a little bit different. The goal is not to develop a new narrative. But it's, as Suzuki Roshi said in his talk, I heard him give at my college, Stanford, when I was young, Zen beyond self-consciousness. Zen beyond self-consciousness, rather than a new narrative. And Yogacara Buddhism is the best form of Buddhism, and actually it's just mainstream Buddhism, but it talks in a psychological way about all this stuff, very similarly to psychodynamic therapy. As a matter of fact, Yogacara is a practice of meditation, really. That's what it is. It focuses on meditation. Talks about the storehouse consciousness. Well, the psychodynamic therapist, Freud, talked about the storehouse consciousness. Jung, they use the same words. It's the same words. It's the storehouse consciousness. Well, they don't say unconscious. They say storehouse consciousness. And the goal in meditation, as we know, is to feel the non-differentiation between the iceberg and the water. The non-differentiation. That's the goal. The goal is to let go of all of our projections that come out of the storehouse consciousness. And the storehouse consciousness in Buddhist thought is part of a 3-part process, which any of you who've studied Yogacara know about. 3-part process is we have an experience, a perfume is given off by that experience, that perfume hardens into a seed, coagulates to a seed, and that seed goes into the storehouse consciousness. So the storehouse consciousness includes gazillions of seeds from all of our memories, all of our emotional memories. And it includes wholesome seeds and unwholesome seeds. Because sometimes we have an experience of joy or love, and then that creates a perfume, a positive perfume. Let's say I had an experience in which Jeff and I were dancing together. he's a great dancer. Well, we had an experience dancing together, and that created a really nice perfume. So that next time I saw him, I just thought, oh, there's Jeff. So that's positive. So we have these positive and negative seeds in our storehouse consciousness. And according to these Buddhist teachers, our experience, our lived experience, is a rushing waterfall of perfume seeds experience, perfume seed experience, excuse me, perfume seed experience. Or you can say experience perfume seed. And this, of course, is all about karma, too, but I'm not going to get into this. No, that's a whole other talk. But it's how we get attached and how our consciousness becomes very narrow, and then this stuff gets stored in our storehouse consciousness till it's evoked by seeing someone who is reminiscent of the experience we have, or being in a classroom that's reminiscent, or whatever. So what the goal is in Buddhist meditation is to see this rushing waterfall, referred to by the teachers as a rushing waterfall, or perfume seed experience, to see this rushing waterfall and realize that it's just a waterfall, realize that all this stuff that's coming up is just a movie, and return to our original undividedness with no split. No split. And that's the goal of meditation. No split. And concentration and bare awareness are both important, because without some concentration, we can't do bare awareness. If you're sitting here on the cushion and you're just planning your meal, and then you're planning your next meal the whole time, you can't do bare awareness. So there has to be enough concentration and bare awareness have to go together. There has to be the concentration to do the bare awareness. Even when you're in therapy, you have to have enough presence of mind to be with what's going on instead of somewhere else, right? So the two go together. And we're trying in our zazen to give our full attention to making our mind quiet enough to observe the internal processes of thought, feeling, sensation, desires. And that includes all of the seeds that are there. They're rumbling around and that are causing us to have certain experiences. So, in the Buddhist teaching, the storehouse consciousness is the basis of our personalities. It's the repository of everything that is us, both harmful and beneficial, both wholesome and unwholesome. And like in psychodynamic therapy, the belief is that the contents shape our actions in our lives, right? This shapes our actions in our lives. It just does. But we have to be careful and not think that the storehouse consciousness is a kind of a self or even an unconscious mind, because we reify it and then we forget that it's a collection of attributes that we mistake for a mind or a self. A separate mind or self. So now I'll tell a story that I probably never told. Kind of fits into this talk. Well, I wanted to tell a story, and I wanted some story. I couldn't get this to fit in too well, but maybe it will. So Zen Master Ikkyu, who lived in the 17th century, was a little bit iconoclastic. So Zen Master Ikkyu, when he was an old guy, he went on his round of begging. And when you go on your round of begging, you just wear your begging Kesa, you know, your holy one, your holy, holy one. Why not? And he went up to the door of these really rich people's houses, and he knocked, and they saw, oh, there's this poor old homeless monk. We'll give him 50 cents. So they gave him 50 cents, and he left, and went and bought a whatever for this 50 cents. Couldn't buy much, but something to sustain him. And then the next day, he said to his attendants, Ikkyu was actually a big guy in terms of the hierarchy in Zen. I want to go back to the house. Dress me in all my robes. So he gets all his layers of robes on, and then, of course, he has a purple kesa. You know, a purple kesa is a big deal. We won't get into that, but it's a big deal. So he puts on all his layers and his purple kesa, and his attendants come with him, and he goes to the house, and the servants come. Sensei, come in, and tell us the masters and the mistress. They prepare a wonderful meal for Ikkyu. They invite him in at banquet with all the wonderful foods. And then I tell him to sit down, and he says, no, and he starts taking off his clothes. And at first he takes off his purple robe, and then he takes off his kuromo, and then he takes off his kimono, and then he takes off his jibon. And there ain't much left after that, guys. Ain't much left. And all of it, all the people in the house are just looking. You know, they're just looking. And he said, pointing to their sumptuous feast, he says, all of this belongs to my robe, not to the so-called me. And then he leaves. And he leaves. So bare awareness is real. We do it. Bare awareness is real. But the object of awareness that we get caught on and we develop a self about aren't real. They're not unreal either. They're experienced perfume seed. They're experienced perfume seed. So when Buddhist meditation is taught by the Yogacara teachers, they begin by teaching moral provisioning, what they call moral provision. This is orienting ourselves toward the pursuit of the path and developing the proper character. In other words, it's steps 3, 4, and 5 of the path, right? Speech, action, and livelihood. Orienting ourselves toward the pursuit of the path and developing the proper character. And from the proper character, to do that, we need attitude and resolve. The first two steps of the path, attitude and resolve. Our attitude and resolve begin the moment our aspiration for enlightenment arises. The moment that aspiration arises. So that's the moral provisioning part. And of course, during the moral provisioning, we're trying to get enough wholesome seeds in us so we can do this practice. Because if it's just dominated by unwholesome seeds, we'll just... It won't work for us. We may be able to fake it, but it doesn't work. It's not really working. So, and maybe we should all go into psychodynamic therapy too. But yeah, why not? As seems appropriate to help us develop some good seeds, some wholesome seeds, and to help us deal with those old seeds that keep, from. Geez, I only even knew Mrs. Werner for 9 months. I'm 73 years old. I knew her for 9 months. But that seed, there it is. There it is. There it is. So through concentration and bare awareness, the grasper-grasped dichotomy is actually stops. It stops that dichotomy. And the cognitive obstructions are no longer lodged in this psyche. They're just stuff that floats, because there isn't any this psyche. There's just being. There's just bare awareness. And that's seeing through undividedness. Doesn't mean there's still not an iceberg in the ocean, but there's a feeling that the iceberg is the ocean, that the ocean is the iceberg. There needs to be an iceberg. We need to have ego. Very important. And as a result of this, the Yogacara says, people say, then we're really ripe. Our wholesome seeds have ripened, and we've let go of seed contamination so we can help all beings. Because everything in Buddhism is ultimately about helping all beings. Everything. There's no point in doing anything if our goal is not to help all beings, because we're undivided from all beings. Duh. So the basic premise of Suzuki Roshi's teaching to me was that self-consciousness, I mean, he never said this, but this was his basic teaching. When we're caught up in self-consciousness, we're out of balance because we're suffering about suffering. That's out of balance. And that through meditation practice, we can resume to what's our natural balance. Even though we say resume, we don't remember it, but it's there. So here's the 17th Zen teacher, Munenori. When you are writing, if you are conscious of writing, your pen will be unsteady. Even when you play the harp, if you are conscious of playing the harp, the tune will be off. So the neuro-linguistic therapists have done research about the conscious mind, and they have done enough research to say unequivocally that the conscious mind can only pay attention to chunks of information at once. Five chunks of information. Now, if you're really calm, the conscious mind could pay attention to up to seven chunks. And if you're not calm, it can pay attention maybe to two or three chunks. So that's very interesting, isn't it? So, but Zen, beyond self-consciousness, can respond to the whole situation. Therapy can be really useful to identify and let go of specific unwholesome seeds. But ultimately, Zen beyond self-consciousness is just responding and giving and responding. That's all it is. That's all it is. Giving and taking. In a joyful way. In a joyful way. So here's the 16th century Zen master Takuan. At the beginning, you know nothing of... Oh, he's talking about the swordsman. As a beginner, you know nothing of the stance or sword position, so you have nothing in yourself to dwell on mentally. If someone strikes at you, you just fight without thinking of anything. Then when you learn various things like stance, how to wield a sword, where to place the attention, and so on, your mind lingers on various points. So you find yourself all tangled up when you try to strike. But if you practice day after day and month after month, just like we do in meditation, eventually stance and sword play don't hang on your mind anymore, and you are like a beginner who knows nothing. The cogitating side of your brain will vanish, and you will come to rest in a state where there is no concern. This is not just myth, you guys. It's not just myth. It's something that you can do, that we can all do. So here's Milton Erickson sounding like a Zen master. I'm not saying he was a Zen master. I'm just saying he's sounding like a Zen master here. Talking about the role of a therapist. The therapist maintains a stance of heightened receptivity, uncontaminated by formulaic preconceptions. Too many psychotherapists try to plan what thinking they will do, instead of waiting to see what the stimulus they receive is and letting their unconscious mind respond to the stimulus. So I want to finish with two stories. The first story, so I've been practicing meditation for a decade or so, and I'd had a number of experiences of just dying to Tim completely, wonderful experiences, but it didn't mean I was free of unwholesome seeds. Although there's a wonderful illusion when you have these experiences. Woo! You know, they're never going to have an unwholesome seed again. Well, you're creating an unwholesome seed when you say, I'm never going to have one again. Because you're stifling. You're stifling what is process. So let's see, I was in therapy this time, and some unwholesome seeds were, you know, knocking around inside, so I decided to see a therapist, and having some problems with my sweetheart, who was not, didn't seem so sweet after 10, 12 years or whatever it is. Talking with my, and this psychodynamic therapist, talking with my therapist, and talking about the fact that my wife was on my case for not apologizing. And I said to him, "Well, you know, I apologize when it's justified." And I said, "I need to defend myself because she's usually off base." And he said, "Oh, interesting, interesting, very interesting." And I wonder where you learned that. And I said, "Oh, my dad. My dad never apologized to my mom, and she was always wanting to apologize. And he was a lawyer, so he always had to, you know, make a case before he'd decide whether she deserved my apology. By that time, she was just... And so we did that little exercise, just a little exercise. That's all we did. And then I went home, and I started apologizing to my wife. And I've been apologizing to her ever since. I screw up all the time. I do nasty things all the time. I don't want to, but I got lots of seeds, right? So I apologize, apologize, apologize. Not always, but, you know. But I don't have to stop. And I mean, she's hurting. But when someone else is hurting, we don't need to figure out if we're to blame. We should just go with them when they're hurting, don't you think? Isn't that what the iceberg would do with the water when it knows it's water? And the last story I'm going to tell is in my book, and I've told it many times. So the talk that I heard my teacher give at Stanford when I was an undergraduate was, as I said, Zen Beyond Self-Consciousness. That was the title of the talk. And I thought, well, that is quite a title. He never even mentioned self-consciousness in all the times he talked to me. I figured that somebody else gave the title of that talk. But anyway, it intrigued me. So then I was sitting next to him in the front row before he gave the talk. And about a month before, he'd been on the radio. He'd been on KFI AI radio in Berkeley. And he had not had a good time. He said it was like talking to air. How could you talk to air? He had not had a good time. But somebody had talked him into doing this. I know who had talked him into doing it. Anyway, giving this talk at Stanford. So there he was sitting next to me. And a bunch of students there. And he kind of turns to me just before he's going to go up. And he says, "I'm scared." And he gently holds my hand. He's never touched me at all. I don't think Japanese men touch other men, but I'm scared. And, I just, you know, hold his hand back a minute. I'm a student, so. And then he gets up, and he gives this wonderful talk where he's free, spontaneous, laughing, available to everybody. And my friend afterwards said, "Boy, that teacher really does live Zen beyond self-consciousness. He really does live that." But just before, he had a seed. He had a seed from a stinky perfume from talking on KFAI. And that seed made him scared. He saw that seed in his bare awareness, just that moment of bare awareness, he completely saw it, and even violated the Japanese boundary between a man and his student, a boy student. At least I think, I'm not sure. You have to ask Tomoe about that. And then did it in his bare awareness. So I think that's what I want to say, and we have about 5 or 10 minutes for questions or comments. And of course, This is really a, what I thought about this. This should have been, there are about 8 or 10 talks in here because there's just so much material, both from Buddhism and from psychotherapy. And there's so much overlap, so much wonderful overlap, and yet some important distinction. Yeah.
So I need a little bit of help about the distinction between a wholesome and an unwholesome seed.
Oh, yeah.
So if Mrs. Warner, if we go back,
yeah,
indeed had indigestion, and you had a distortion of interpretation of look on her face,
yeah,
I can see where that leads to an unwholesome sort of outcome. It's sort of whatever. But the positive could also be a distortion. I mean, that person who came in might say, well, I want to boost people's ego, so I'll say whatever will make them feel good. And it's not true.
Well, from the Buddhist point of view, all seeds are distortions. Mm-hmm. All seeds are distortions.
Okay.
But we need enough positive seeds.
What makes the difference between a wholesome and an unwholesome seed?
A wholesome seed helps us maintain our integrity, our focus, our balance as we live in the world. And really what therapy is about is helping us get in contact with our unwholesome and then develop as many wholesome as possible. And then what Zen is about is seeing through all the seeds. But to see through all the seeds, sometimes we need therapy because we have to have... If I'm just dominated by these unwholesome seeds, I can't really sit well. I can't really relate even to my students.
That's very helpful.
Sure. Lawrence.
I remember from a Freudian theory, I was here, he was superconscious. How does that fit in with
Buddhism? Well, I don't know what you're talking about when you say superconscious. Freud didn't actually believe that there was a superconscious. Sometimes he used the term subconscious. I can't. Superego. Oh, superego, yes. So the superego, there is superego. Superego is the internalized parent. The internalized parent. The internalized parent is mostly shoulds. So most of the shoulds in our lives come from the internal parent. And we needed to internalize that parent to develop, to be socialized in the world, not to just be savage. We needed that. But that's also very stifling. So there are lots of negative seeds from that, I shouldn't do this, this is bad, I'm bad if I do this, I'm bad if I do that. So that's a super ego. Yeah. Benton.
Do you know Suzuki's talk that you mentioned is recorded?
Oh, I really doubt it. Yeah. This would have been, you know, I'm really old. This is like 19, I don't know, how many years is that? 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they weren't retarded. No, they wouldn't. It might be recorded, but I wouldn't know how, I wouldn't know what to do. You go about looking for it. 50 years. Huh?
I better ask the internet.
Yeah, you could ask the internet. Let's see. What year was that? That was about 1966. So, you know. Other people? Yeah.
My uncle, who's about 73, has the same exact experience with Mr. Warner.
With what? Mrs. Warner? Oh.
Where he's naturally left-handed as well, and his teacher at the time made him force him to write right-handed, and he went completely mute.
Completely mute. Oh, well, luckily I didn't go completely mute.
Oh. And they had to, my grandparents had discussions and then took him to a therapist, and they had to retrain him to write with
the
natural
hand. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a sad story. But, yeah. And could you guys hear what she said? Yeah. No. Jeff.
Happy Father's Day.
Well, thank you.
And to all the fathers and all you who have fathers. So, up until I arrived here about 8 years ago, I was in a couple of sagas that had a different approach to Zen practice. There was kind of a blended Soto Rinzai sangha. So we used koans in addition to bare awareness. And in fact, students could make a choice. But koan practice was kind of the thing that I was doing before I came here. And one of the things about koan practice is, well, yes, there's a koan that you're working on. And in the course of sesshin or even weekly meditation sessions, you go in and talk to the teacher. And you could talk about anything relating to your practice, but at some point the koan would come up. And you know, the teacher would ask questions like, well, when you were picking out dog poo in the park, where was Moo? So, but the idea was that the koan practice was not something that happened just on the cushion. It happened out in the world as well. And we were encouraged to carry that practice out into the world. So that's one thing about it. But the second thing about it is whatever your response was to the teacher, chances are the teacher would just say, well, he wouldn't say anything. He would just ring you out. He'd ring the bell, and that meant you either get up and leave. Or he'd, or she would say, dig deeper, keep working, and ring the bell. So you get to experience a lot of, that wasn't right. So as I say, since I've been here, I do bare awareness practice on the cushion some of the time. Also, you know, I also have kind of carried on this koan practice. And a lot of that happens out in the world. So here's a koan that my researchers have uncovered. Dogen says to the monk, Buddha's teaching is for the liberation of all beings. Why is there so little melanin in this sangha?
Well, that's a good koan, and you continue to work with that. And we can all work with it. It's important. Anything else?
Just a brief koan from an American Zen master, Yogi Berra.
Okay.
If the world were perfect, I wouldn't be.
Did you hear what he said? Yogi Berra says, if the world were perfect, it wouldn't be. So thank you. Thank you all.